We're doing a year-end check-in, if you will, with UW-Madison Chancellor Rebecca Blank here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. What a year it's been. Big breath, robust COVID testing on campus, quarantining of dorms and Greek houses, crafting a UW budget in a pandemic and maneuvering through Big Ten play. And then there's the future to contend with. What will infection rates be like when students return for the spring semester in late January? What do you want to ask Chancellor Blank? It's 800-642-1234. Rebecca Blank has been the Chancellor of UW-Madison since 2013. Chancellor Blank, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thanks for asking me.
Well, it's been a rough year for everyone. What's been the hardest thing for you to deal with during this pandemic?
You know, I think the hardest part of this for myself and many of the leaders is that the world kept changing, right? Mm. You'd sort of think you had control over what the questions were that you needed to answer. And then a week later, you'd find out there were a whole set of new questions and issues that you had to pivot to and deal with, so that you sort of never got ahead of things. You were always dealing with another sense of an emergency.
As you look back at the year, is there anything that you would have done differently?
Yeah, you know, I think the thing that we would most likely have done different as we look back is right at the beginning of the fall semester, as many people know, we had a spike in cases that resulted in us really shutting some things down for 2 weeks. We could have done a better job of preventing that had we started earlier with all of our prevention measures. We had everything ready to go the day that school started. And it turns out that particularly among our students who were off campus, many of them were back well before that. Mm-hmm. And we weren't doing as much messaging earlier about the health protocols, the importance of not bar hopping and gathering in large groups. And we should have started that sooner. And I think that would have helped prevent that first spike in some ways.
What communication did you have in those days in the fall with bars and restaurants and the places that students frequent?
So I personally did not have that conversation. I did have a number of conversations with the Dane County Public Health. I was quite concerned that the rules that were out there were not being enforced. And you could see that by walking down the street on a Friday or Saturday night. And when those rules started to be enforced, and of course, that was also the point that we really asked students to restrict movements for several weeks and went online for 2 weeks, things improved. And then they stayed for the rest of the semester much better. Our numbers all the way through the rest of the semester were below the county and far below the state, particularly in November and December when the state took off with high infection rates.
The Big Ten was criticized for going ahead with a football season this year after initially canceling the season. And in retrospect, do you think it was a good idea to play football this season?
So, you know, I find criticism of the Big Ten a little odd here. We, I think, were far more careful and responsible than the other leagues that were playing. We delayed the start of the year until we thought we had a protocol that would keep our students as safe as possible. Once we started, we were doing daily testing of all of the staff and students on the teams that were in active competition. Now, that by itself was not enough, as we all know, to prevent some infections happening at some of the teams, including at UW-Madison. But, you know, we've had some pretty serious health protocols in place, both to try to prevent disease as well as when students get ill, to take care of them. So if you test positive and you're a football player, you don't come back for 21 days. The first 14 days, you know, you're in isolation for all the reasons we know about. The next week, you're undergoing a whole series of cardiac and other medical tests to make sure that there is not any damage and that you can go back to active athletic competition. And I don't know any other league in the country that's doing that type of medical protocol.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Rebecca Blank, Chancellor of UW-Madison. We're looking back at the year that was, how the university will deal with the pandemic in 2021, and taking your questions, 800-642-1234. Chancellor, with vaccines now imminent, being rolled out very soon, perhaps the end of the pandemic may be in sight, but it's certainly not over yet. And what will spring semester look like for UW-Madison students and faculty?
So unfortunately, I don't think the spring is going to look very different from the fall. We're not going to have large-scale vaccination in place until at best the end of the spring, the summer. So we are planning for a spring semester that in many ways looks a lot like the fall. We're going to have hybrid courses, some in person, some online. I think most of our students will be back in Madison just as they were in the fall. The big thing that we're doing differently is a much more extensive testing regime. We now have the technologies that we will have in place by the middle of January to test our entire campus population twice a week if needed. And we are going to mandate that all of our students in the Madison area test twice a week, and that our staff and faculty test regularly, probably about once a week. So that in addition, if you add that to the other health protocols, that should make the campus even safer.
What are the cost expenditures with those additional testing, ramped up testing? Are there COVID expenses that we may not realize?
Well, it's certainly not cheap to do all the testing we've done this fall or this spring. We were fortunate this fall in that the state, with some of the federal dollars, gave money to the UW system, some of which came to us, that covered a substantial part of our testing costs. I do not know if that's going to be true in the spring, but, regardless of cost, the testing and health protocols are absolutely mandatory if we're going to be in school this spring. So, the cost is a secondary issue, not a primary issue.
Are there plans for the university to be vaccinating students and staff once vaccines are available?
I would love to see that happen. We are so early in the process that we don't have the type of information yet to know when we might get vaccines, if they're going to be distributed to us, if they're going to be inside the health system and you have to go find a doctor. We, of course, would like to be able to vaccinate our community. We've done a lot of vaccinations. We do flu vaccinations every fall. We'd love to be able to offer that, but there's a lot to be worked out yet before we quite know that's going to happen.
Have there been conversations about whether a vaccination would be required for students and staff?
I think as long as this vaccination is under an emergency use authorization, which is not quite the same as final approval, it's going to be difficult to require the vaccination. That said, I'm going to be first in line to get this, and we are all going to encourage everyone in our campus community to be vaccinated.
When you look around the campus, Chancellor, are you concerned that you're going to have to do some program cuts, have to eliminate degree programs, majors or minors?
So we are in a serious one-year financial crisis. We have a substantial cash flow shortage because of revenues that aren't coming in for all sorts of COVID-related reasons. That's different from a long-term budget crisis. And when if you're going to cut programs and departments, you do that because of long-term budget crises. We're trying very hard to manage through this. It's not easy. We have asked quite a bit from our staff and employees. As you probably know, we've asked furlough days from all of them. We've cut back on a lot of expenditures. We're putting a lot of our reserves into this. There are a whole variety of ways in which we're covering our cash flow problems this year. But I do not anticipate that we are, we will be making some budget cuts, but those are not going to be so deep that they're going to go into cutting substantial programs and departments.
We're working through 2020, how UW-Madison handled the pandemic during the fall semester with Chancellor Rebecca Blank. Continues to be free COVID testing on campus that's open to the community through a partnership between the UW and the federal government. Have you been tested on campus? What suggestions do you have for how UW-Madison can persevere through the remainder of the pandemic? What do you think the university should do differently in 2021? Join in with your take, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Chancellor Blank here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We're reflecting back on the year, looking ahead with UW-Madison Chancellor Rebecca Blank. COVID is forcing colleges and universities of all sizes to make potentially lasting cuts to try to shore up growing shortfalls and Red Ink. The economic downturn is pushing higher ed toward more furloughs, layoffs. UW-Madison will continue furloughs in 2021 to help offset hundreds of millions of dollars in lost revenue. Have you been furloughed or laid off? What could the university do to mitigate the impact? Is your college student taking classes virtually? How has that gone? 800-642-1234. And Chancellor Blank is with us for 10 more minutes. Let's take a call now. Saeed's joining us from Green Bay. Hi, Saeed.
Hello, and thanks for taking my call. Chancellor, transition of instruction to online, which has been experienced in so many campuses, and some may argue making learning even more efficient. What do you think is the legacy of this period in its in what we've learned, and how it will alter higher education in the post-COVID era?
That's a great question, Saeed. I will say that I think one of the things we've learned all over again is the value of face-to-face conversation and instruction. We did a survey of our undergraduates about three-fourths of the way through this past semester, and large numbers of them said what they really valued more than anything else was that one or two classes they had in person, and they just wished that more and more classes were like that. All of that said, our faculty have learned an enormous amount about new technologies that many of them were not using before. And I do think that there's going to be some serious thought about how do you use that very precious time that you have with your faculty when you are in the classroom, and is that best used by standing in front of a blackboard or a projector and lecturing, or can you do some of that transfer of material in other ways so that the time on the classroom is really spent in the most active form of learning, in discussion, in working through problems, in looking at implications of different things. I think there's going to be some changes in teaching, but I do think this is simply reiterated all over again, the real value of residential education and online face-to-face learning for many, many people.
Yeah, you know, there have been those criticisms that, you know, going virtual online classes are not as valuable, that there should be an adjustment in tuition. What do you say to that criticism?
Well, our costs haven't gone down, nor have the costs of any other school. We have a world-class group of faculty teaching our classes. They're teaching them in a different modality than they were before. But the value of the information that those faculty have and that they're imparting in the classroom hasn't changed. So, you know, we have not adjusted our tuition rates. To be the University of Wisconsin, we need those sorts of faculty. We need the type of advising, the sort of mental health services, the full range of things we provide. And that comes with a price tag.
Well, let's talk about tuition for a moment. Should the tuition freeze be lifted?
Yes. That's an easy answer. Look, we've had 8 years of a price freeze at the university. If you compare us to our peer schools, you know, we're in Minnesota, Illinois, Michigan, Ohio, the schools that are right around us, all of them over the last 8 years have seen something between a 10 to 20% increases in state tuition. And we've had zero. And I don't want to raise tuition by huge amounts, but we need to adjust for inflation. Our salaries are going up. Our costs are going up. It's not unreasonable to ask tuition prices to go up. And I might note the University of Wisconsin is a really good deal. Our tuition and fees are around $10,500. Now, that's a lot of money for a low-income family, and we provide a lot of scholarships for them. But for higher-income families, comparing us to other equivalently good schools, we're cheaper than most of them. And, you shouldn't give away your goods at the cheapest possible price. What you should do is charge a reasonable price and discount for all of those people you want to have there, and for whom the price is a little bit high. It's one reason we're running something called Bucky's Tuition Promise, which guarantees we'll provide financial aid to all students who come from low-income families in the state of Wisconsin. And we cover all tuition and fees for them for 4 years.
Talking with Rebecca Blank, Chancellor of UW-Madison, looking at what the university faces going forward in 2021. Chancellor, you were looking at revenue losses more than double than what you anticipated in late October, $320 million in lost revenue between March of this year and end of June 30th, 2021. Do you have any revised estimates?
No, those are the estimates we're working with. We're talking about, we're going to be short about $320 million compared to where we thought we'd be last January. Like I say, some of that we've made up by reducing expenses. Some of that we've made up by using our using reserves. Some of that we're simply going to have to make up through some budget cuts that we amortize over the coming years. The good news here, there's two pieces of good news. One is we do not have a long-term problem in terms of demand for our product. A lot of schools in the upper Midwest are seeing declines in applications. That's not true for us. We've seen steady increases in applications. The number of people wanting to come to UW has gone up every year for the last 6 years, and our applications are up another 13% year over year right now. That's great news. And I have every expectation. The other piece of good news is when things get back to normal, I hope that's next fall, you know, all that, those revenues will be back. You know, all the things that stopped things, money from flowing in this past year is not going to be there once COVID is over. And our unions, our athletic program, our dorms, everything will be back to normal. And that's just a good position to be in.
In the meantime, the second round of furloughs is planned for next year, and senior leaders will be given 15% pay cuts. Could there be layoffs or further cuts?
So we have told all of our units that they will be facing budget cuts and have told them what the magnitude of those budget cuts are going to be. We do have to deal with this cash flow shortage. And as I say, we sort of have to amortize it. We can't handle it all this for year. We're going to have to amortize it over future years. And that is why we are passing down budget cuts. Those are not excessive. They're in the range of 4 to 6 to 8% for most units. But we do have to be serious about making sure that we are financially responsible and deal with the financial crisis that COVID has placed on us.
UW-Madison is sitting on a $3.3 billion endowment. When you talk with the foundation and the Alumni Association, is there any latitude to use some of that endowment, latitude in making restricted gifts unrestricted?
So virtually all of that money is allocated to very specific things. People very rarely give money to the university and say, spend this any way you want. They want to fund a scholarship. They want to fund a named professorship. They want to fund a very specific program. And we have contracts with all of those individuals saying, this is how we will spend your money. Let me say, if we did not have those sorts of gifts, we would be in much deeper and more serious financial trouble than we are. So that endowment has been just golden for us. But it's not money that we can spend at will. It is money that is tied to very specific activities. And we're obligated to spend it that way by the wishes of the donors. I wouldn't want to do anything differently.
I want to turn to the climate on the campus here and certainly race relations. There have been growing calls to make UW-Madison more inclusive, more diverse. What is the university doing to hire more diverse faculty?
So, you know, I take this issue very seriously. 3 years ago, we started a program aimed at increasing diversity among our faculty that we call the Targets of Opportunity Program TOP, which provides substantial incentives for departments to hire faculty from faculty who are underrepresented in their department and in their field. You know, that could be racial or ethnic, that could be gender, that could be based on some of the things that they study and work on. Over 2 years, we have made 32 hires. The vast majority of those are people of color. Some of them are women in some of our science fields. And even in the midst of a very difficult budget year, I've been very clear that we are going to continue to put money into the TOP program and continue to do that type of hiring. We need to do it at Madison. We are you know, they call a predominantly white institution. We need more diversity amongst our faculty, and this program has been very important for that.
There have been a series of racist incidents that have occurred on campus, including racist graffiti, a fraternity suspended due to racist slurs. What is your administration doing to address the climate for students here at the university?
So we're working on, you know, generally three major areas and have been for a number of years. One is diversity in the people who are there, both among our students and our faculty. We just talked about the faculty. The second is training and programs that are educational. We're an educational institution, and we have a lot of people arriving, particularly 18-year-olds from small towns where things are much less diverse than they are on campus. And we try to work with students. We have mandatory training for everyone who arrives to talk about their identity, where they're coming from, where others are coming from, how you live and work with people who come from different backgrounds. And that education is absolutely important. The third thing that we are working on is support for our communities of color. We've established affinity groups for many of our faculty and staff from different identities. We've, over the last 5 and 6 years, established cultural centers in the Red Gym for a variety of student groups who want a place to come together and hang out.
Chancellor Blank, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's always good to talk to you, Kate.
Rebecca Blank, Chancellor at UW-Madison. For Disclosure, WPR is a service of UW-Madison. UW Health is a regional distribution point for the Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine. We're discussing how UW Health is preparing to receive shipments and to store the vaccine. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The vaccines will go to frontline healthcare providers first. Are you in this group? What do you want to know about availability and distribution? Are you a healthcare practitioner in a rural setting? What questions do you have about vaccine logistics? It's 800-642-1234. Dr. Matthew Anderson is Senior Medical Director of Ambulatory Operations at UW Health, where he's a Clinical Associate Professor at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Anderson, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
So Wisconsin will be receiving about 65,000 doses of COVID vaccines in the next couple weeks. Where will this first shipment go?
So the shipment will go from the Department of Health Services will be to the area's distribution centers that they have geographically dispersed across the state. From there, there will be distribution then out according to the allocation from the State Disaster Medical Advisory Committee to other spokes in other areas that may not have the ultra-cold freezers needed to store the Pfizer vaccine.
So how is UW Health preparing for the shipment? What are you doing?
Yeah, so there's a lot of logistical considerations, I think, as have been out there. We are getting set with our practices and protocols for the ultra-cold freezers and making sure that everything's set there from our pharmacy and facilities teams. There's a lot that's going into how we're going to then get that to our employees. So a lot of operational planning. How do we notify employees which group they're in, if they're in phase 1A or not in the first phase? And then how do we go through the logistics of training our staff, getting people ready to be able to administer the vaccine so that when we get the go-ahead, we're able to have really efficient processes and move through those quickly.
What about these ultra-cold freezers? They have to be about negative 94 degrees Fahrenheit. What are some of the obstacles there?
Yeah, I think one is just having the freezers themselves, which we do, but can be a barrier, you know, for some organizations, which is why the state is looking to some of these geographic distribution centers. And then I think it's just more, we do continuous temperature monitoring and freezers and for vaccine-related purposes and other medications on a chronic basis. So it's something we're familiar with, but it's not something, you know, at this level with these particular freezers. So it's just logistically making sure that we have all the right processes in place for those. And then the challenge with some of the doses is these are multi-dose vials, and they can only be good outside of those freezer temperature locations for a certain period of time of days. So we have to just make sure that we're managing the distribution and the administration in such a way that we don't waste any vaccine. So a lot of good work has gone into that, and we feel confident that we're prepared.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, how long can this vaccine go outside? Once you pull it out of the freezer, how much time do you have in order to make sure it doesn't go bad between the time that you pull it out and put it in someone's arm?
Yeah, so with refrigeration, you've got about 5 days. There are some more extended practices you could take, but we won't be needing to from a dry ice standpoint. But you're about 5 days at that point. And then once you've compounded and done everything you need to do to get it in there and open that vial dose, you've got about 6 hours.
6 hours. Okay. And so how is UW Health then going to structure who gets this vaccine and when, especially in the first round here in the Pfizer vaccines?
Yeah, so I think the first thing is that the CDC and DHS and the State Disaster Medical Advisory Committee are the ones who set, you know, who's in the phase 1A population. So that's where the frontline healthcare workers with direct contact with patients or exposure to infectious materials, and then you have long-term care residents included within that as well. When we get that, then we have been sorting through who had within our workforce one fits into the phase 1A population, so designating who are those people. And the second thing is then who has the, for us, how we're approaching it, is who has the highest risk of exposure in their work, and then how do we identify those individuals and then work through just the operational planning to make sure that we're offering the vaccine people in an equitable way.
Okay, and then so in terms of equity, then UW Health is one, of course, one health system. But what about the other hospitals in that are in your distribution area? How does that work?
So really, we are a storage facility, so we have the freezer requirements, and then we collaborate and coordinate with DHS, who then tells us. Actually, how many of the doses are for UW Health, and then how many doses are designated for other locations. DHS then would coordinate getting the vaccine to those other locations who are in phase 1A vaccinators from that standpoint. So we really defer to the state on that part.
Okay. And so basically, as a distribution hub, the state's telling you to say, okay, have this many vaccines in ready to go, and we'll pick them up from you and take them where they need to go?
Right. They're doing the transportation logistics. And really, again, we're giving them access to the freezer and supporting them and getting that. And then they take it from there. Correct.
Talking with Dr. Matt Anderson, Senior Medical Director of Ambulatory Operations at UW Health. He's explaining how the COVID vaccines will be handled once they reach Wisconsin next week. Your questions as well at 800-642-1234. Dr. Anderson, walk us through the timelines as to when these vaccines will come in your door.
Yeah, so a couple of steps in there, and there certainly, as you can appreciate, I think there's some fluidity to this whole thing right now. So tomorrow, the FDA is meeting, and we are hopeful that the emergency use authorization will come forward tomorrow, Friday, somewhere in that time frame. We're hearing that we can expect our first shipment of vaccine likely early in the week next week, and so we're prepared for that and just waiting for some more specifics as DHS and others are able to give them to us.
Okay. And so besides the Pfizer vaccine, Moderna has a vaccine. Can you explain the steps around Moderna's vaccine?
Yeah, so the distribution of Moderna is a little bit different because it does not have the ultra-cold freezer storage requirements. And so with that, I believe if and when that is approved and they have an EUA for that, that'll be more of a direct shipment from the manufacturer to the vaccinator location. So there won't need to be a central distribution plan with spokes, but it'll be identifying those people who have signed up to be phase 1A vaccinators. And then there'll be an allocation process through the state. And then so we as UW Health will then receive our allocation only, as opposed to with Pfizer, where we're receiving ours plus others.
Gotcha. Okay, so between the Pfizer vaccine and the Moderna vaccine, how many doses are we looking at here?
Yeah, I think that's still a little bit uncertain. I mean, I think we've heard about the state level. We've heard for us likely in the several thousand dosing coming soon. But we really haven't heard much on the specifics of the Moderna vaccine yet. So I think we're still waiting for that and hopeful, just like everybody else is, to get some greater clarity and get moving on this.
What is the difference between the Pfizer vaccine and the Moderna vaccine?
So the biggest difference is a couple, actually. And so one is just that Moderna does not have to be stored, as I mentioned, at the same degree of lower temperatures that the Pfizer vaccine does. The other difference is really that is the interval between the first and second dose, which is 21 days for Pfizer and 28 days for Moderna. So that creates some small logistical challenges for us, but it's manageable. Otherwise, they both are mRNA vaccines, and I'll defer the vaccine science to, you know, other folks around all the specifics of that, but they really are similar in that fashion of how they accomplish the task of providing immunity.
So when you, as UW Health, looks to distribute among your employees, are you going to do these vaccines in a central place, or are you going to try to distribute them throughout the department so employees don't have to go to a central location?
Yeah, so especially first, we're going to have more central distribution just because of some of the challenges is with the ultra-cold storage with the Pfizer vaccine, and just making sure that we can do that safely and as conveniently as possible for us. And then we'll likely have two locations early on, and then as we get into understanding what the operations are, how much volume and quantity we're going to have, we may expand that out in the future, but we don't have immediate plans on that right now.
Are there any plans for how you may monitor at all your employees' health after taking the vaccine?
Yeah, so monitoring for side effects is absolutely something that we do on a regular basis and have practices and processes in place. So we'll be working with our employee health team to make sure that employees have the ability and that we are expecting, especially under the EUA, that it's going to be important that they're reporting what those side effects are. So we have internal processes we've worked through and that, you know, are somewhat commonplace for us, and we're going to need to monitor those as things go along and react accordingly.
Yeah, and so when you have those internal monitoring for vaccines, are you talking about, like, electronic computer systems? Like, how do you monitor?
Yeah, so we have a patient safety net system that people can go in and enter something and it gets through. We also have other means of also telephonically or otherwise contacting our employee health team. And so obviously the electronic options are a little bit more streamlined for our staff. And that's something we're going to be monitoring just to make sure that we understand what the volume is and how we make it, again, convenient for people to report side effects they may or may not have.
Rural areas are likely, I would have supposed, to receive the Moderna vaccine since it doesn't need to be kept extremely cold, can be shipped directly. Is the plan to mostly send then that vaccine to more remote places in the state?
Yeah, it's a good comment. It's, you know, makes some sense in theory. I would defer to the state about the allocation and dispensation planning at this point. I've not heard anything definitive on that, although, to your point, there's some theoretical conceptual sense to that.
We're talking with internist Matt Anderson with UW Health. He's explaining its partnership with the state to distribute the Pfizer vaccine to health systems and long-term care facilities in the region in the weeks and months to come. What do you want to know about how the COVID-19 vaccine works and when you might be able to get it? Are you a frontline healthcare worker in a rural part of Wisconsin? What are your thoughts about vaccine distribution and rollout? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Back in a minute with Dr. Anderson here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with Dr. Matt Anderson of UW Health. He's Senior Medical Director, Ambulatory Operations, and he's explaining how UW Health will be a central storage facility for the Pfizer vaccine, which has to be stored at a very cold temperature to remain stable. Wisconsin, by the by, has more than 450,000 healthcare workers. The vaccines will go to frontline healthcare workers first. Let's take a call on this now. Taylor is joining us from Stone Lake. Hi, Taylor.
Hi, I was just wanting to ask, because being that I'm in a rural area, an 80-year-old grandparent, can I project that they would get the vaccine?
Okay, Taylor is in a rural area and has grandparents who are 80 years old. When might they get the vaccine, Dr. Anderson?
Yeah, so still thinking about, and people are still working through what the next phases are going to be, but, you know, based on their age, we would anticipate that they would likely be in the phase 1B population. That's really going to be dependent upon how many vaccines we receive, but estimates would be that maybe sometime in the spring that we'd be able to move into that phase. So rough estimate at this point.
The spring. Okay, let's bring in Amy now in Portage. Hi, Amy. I understand your daughter is a COVID ICU nurse.
She is. And my main concern is this. I know that she'll be one of the first recipients or eventually one of the first recipients of the vaccine. What happens if, God forbid, there is something wrong with the vaccine and we have large numbers of our healthcare workers that are affected or negatively affected by the vaccine? How will that affect our public health care then when our health care workers are out?
Dr. Anderson.
Yeah, thanks for the question. I think that that's obviously a very appropriate concern that we're all thinking about. How do we make sure we're maintaining operations and able to provide care for the people who need it through this time? You know, it's something that we're working through as far as, do you need to stagger schedules? How many people, you know, what are the adverse effects going to be? And the FDA just published some information, a little bit more detail about that yesterday. So each health system will be looking through that to identify what's the cadence that we need to vaccinate people with. How do we best operationalize that and make sure that we're not negatively impacting operations at the same time? So each health system may have, and each specialty may have a little bit different situation. So really, we are going to be working through that just as other health systems are as well. And so just know that we're all very committed to making sure that, one, we vaccinate people appropriately and quickly within the right phase, and two, that we do so in a way that doesn't compromise operations. So it's a challenge, but it's something that the health systems have experience in handling and will be ready to do when the time comes.
And Dr. Anderson, these are pressing questions, like how long is someone immune once they get the vaccine, and will people who are vaccinated, are they still contagious? What is known about these types of questions?
Yeah, so those are great questions, and I think that everybody wants certainty right now. We crave certainty, and you know, I think the answer there is really going to be that we have preliminary information about near-term immunity, and that gives us hope for what it may mean, but we're going to need to continue to study these vaccines and understand, you know, are there subsequent doses that are going to be necessary, all of those sorts of things, which is one of the reasons that the FDA is putting that through as an emergency use authorization and saying, you know, we need to continue to learn more. But at the same time, the benefits outweigh the risks, and there's been good safety data here over the subsequent couple of months, so we have a reasonable handle on it, but we need to continue to learn more, and we want that certainty as much as everybody else does, and we'll definitely be sharing information as we have it as we go along.
So PPE, personal protective equipment, after healthcare workers are vaccinated, after, you know, the Amy's daughter, COVID ICU nurse is vaccinated, will the same PPE requirements stay in place at UW Health? Are your frontline workers going to continue to use the same type of equipment as precaution, even though they're vaccinated?
Absolutely. We are continuing to message the importance and need to have our PPE in place to protect ourselves, to protect our patients as we continue to learn more and, you know, continue to reinforce the need for physical distancing, mask wearing, hand hygiene, all of those things. So just because we're getting vaccinated doesn't mean that we're flipping the switch back to life as normal. We're going to need to continue to take those precautions in the ways that we have and then work our way towards a future state where we're able to get back closer to a pre-COVID normalcy.
Okay, so what I'm hearing from you, just because you get the COVID vaccine or series of vaccines doesn't mean that you stop wearing a mask.
That's correct. Absolutely. Absolutely. Appreciate the reinforcement on that.
We're talking with Dr. Matt Anderson, heading up logistics for the Pfizer COVID vaccines that will arrive in at UW Health next week, or anticipated to arrive next week. the emergency youth authorization will be taken up tomorrow. And Dr. Anderson is a medical director at UW Health, fielding your questions about vaccines and about what the protocol should be in the logistics of handling the forthcoming vaccine. The number is 800-642-1234. So, Dr. Anderson, how can people figure out when they might be eligible to receive a vaccine?
Yeah, I think at this point, again, that's part of that certainty that we all crave. We would suggest that the broader availability of the general public is going to be more in the months, so probably in the early spring to, spring to early summer timeframe. And it depends on the number of vaccines that end up receiving emergency use authorization, the amount of supply that we're able to receive from each of those vaccines, and then how quickly we can move through vaccinating those in the initial phases. And so I think that when we talk about months, it's really predicated and dependent on those variables in place, and they could change. And I think people just stay tuned, but really we're talking more about probably into the spring, early summer timeframe for broader availability.
I want to talk a little bit here about procurement and about making room in your freezers for these thousands of vaccines. What happens to the medicines that are already in these extremely cold freezers? And do you have enough space to make room for what is coming?
Yeah, I can speak for us. We absolutely do. We have the ability with our freezers to take up to 300,000 doses for the ultra-cold storage. There aren't a lot of we purchase net new freezers, so we're not displacing or dislodging anything from there. So there aren't, a number of medications or other things that we would typically use these for in a large volume. So we're in good shape from that standpoint.
Let's go to Ian now from Milwaukee. Hi, Ian. And you are a truck driver.
Yes, I'm a truck driver in Wisconsin, and I'm just wondering logistically, how are you going to use the trucking industry to move these, vaccines, in bulk from one area to another, considering there is a very large shortage of truck drivers, within the state, and also the storage facilities at minus 70, and the vehicles can only go down to minus 30 with their refrigerated units.
Great question. Yeah, Dr. Anderson.
Yeah, thanks, Ian, for the question. So from the ultra-cold transportation distribution piece, Pfizer is really heading that up. So that doesn't require a lot from the health systems from that standpoint. I know they put a lot of effort and time into the logistics of how do they get things from here to there. So I don't know all of the details about that, just more at a high-level conceptual. From a UW Health standpoint, again, as I think I mentioned earlier, we have the ability to take those out of the freezers, keep them at refrigerated temperatures that don't require the same restrictions as we're moving them between our locations. But again, one of the reasons why early on we're looking at a limited number of locations to make sure that we just keep the logistics as simple as possible and keep things efficient.
Not many seconds left here, but what is your toughest challenge? What are you grappling with?
Yeah, I think that, throughout the pandemic, you will hear that health systems have struggled with space, staff, and stuff. So space is not as much of an issue. I mean, one of the challenges for us is just how do we ensure that we have the number of staff that we need to vaccinate, in a quickly, timely fashion. So that's certainly one. It's one that we are addressing and have plans for, so we feel good about it, but it's definitely a challenge. The uncertainty is a challenge for people who are wanting to know more information, and we're in that boat as well. So trying to plan for something when there's a lot of fluidity is definitely a challenge also. And then I think it's just, we haven't done this in this way before, and you're doing it in the middle of a pandemic. So there are just a lot of logistical challenges. But again, we have a great team. We're confident we're ready and preparing, and we'll just have to be flexible and adaptable as we go along. So we're excited to get started.
Dr. Anderson, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me so much. Appreciate it.
Dr. Matt Anderson is Senior Medical Director of Ambulatory Operations at UW Health. Just ahead, we look at how small independent businesses are staying afloat. We check back in with local business developers in Madison and Milwaukee. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.